Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Where did the time go? In a few minutes, those midterm elections we've been looking ahead to are almost here. We'll get an overview from NPR's Charlie Mattesian.
But first, to the ongoing fight against ISIS in the Syrian town of Kobani. The U.S. has been conducting airstrikes around the town, but now, in addition to dropping bombs, it is also dropping weapons and ammunition. That's designed to help the Kurdish fighters who are trying to hold on to Kobani, which is on Syria's border with Turkey. The BBC's Kasra Naji is on the Turkish side of that border. And Kasra, how significant is this U.S. airdrop of weapons and ammunition?
Huge significance. It boosts the morale as well as the fighting capability of the Kurdish fighters here. Don't forget, the coalition strategy is to have airstrikes coupled with an effective ground fighting force. And the Kurdish fighters are that, except for the fact that they didn't have enough weapons, and their weapons are small caliber, small arms, and they needed more weapons and possibly more heavy weapons. Now it seems that they are getting some of that, and on top of that, the Turkish government today has decided to allow Kurdish fighters who are coming from throughout the region to volunteer to fight inside Kobani, to use its territory to get inside Kobani. So altogether, the fighters here received two strong boosts in the arm in terms of morale and the fighting capability.
And Kasra, as we can hear, you're speaking to us out in the field via Skype. Tell us what things look like from where you are.
I'm on top of a hill overlooking Kobani right now, and Kobani is a kilometer away from where I'm standing, and it has been largely quiet for the second day running, except for some skirmishes on the eastern fringe of the town, and an airstrike by the coalition aircraft about 45 minutes ago on the western fringes of the town. Otherwise, the town itself, almost all of it, is clear of ISIS fighters, but they need to keep it that way, and they need to prevent reinforcements for IS to arrive at the city, which means that they have to fight and clear ISIS from surrounding villages and the outskirts of the town, that they have to do in days to come.
So will these new weapons that have been dropped and the ammunition and the entry of these new fighters coming in, the Iraqi Kurdish fighters, will that be enough to keep Kobani out of the hands of ISIS?
Already you get the impression from here that the Kurdish fighters have the upper hand. And as I said, they've got most of the town, most areas of the town. So, yes, weapons will help. In fact, I talked to one of the Kurdish commanders inside the city a few days ago, and a woman, a 32-year-old woman, who's leading the defense of the eastern part of the city. And she was very adamant that American airstrikes have been most useful, and the fact that, you know, now with more weapons and more men, I think the situation could be a lot different, and these airdrops could turn the tide.
Still, Kasra, it's a bit surprising, given all of the battles we've seen in recent years in various countries that have U.S. airstrikes involved, that it's taken so long for this battle of Kobani to shake out. How long do you think it's going to take until this is settled?
Nobody knows. Depends how far IS gets its men inside the country, inside Kobani. If they're planning to do that. But for the moment, with the coalition stepping up its airstrikes, or had been for the last few days, that turned Kobani into a killing field for IS fighters here. And I don't see this fight continue much longer in Kobani, maybe some other place. But as I say, this thing is turning into a killing field. And you would have thought commanders of IS fighters would have to sit down and think long and hard about the fact whether they want to come into this killing field and be killed from above and from below.
And if they were to lose Kobani, what would it mean for ISIS?
Major problem for their morale, I would have thought. But more or less that. So this would be their first major defeat in this coalition.
That's the BBC's Khasra Naji joining us from Turkey's border with Syria. Khasra, thank you.
My pleasure.
Amazing sound. Well, back on the home front, there are just 2 weeks to go before the midterm elections. So much buildup, and here they are. And there's been last-minute drama. Early Saturday morning, the Supreme Court decided to let a controversial Texas voter ID law stand. That ruling may have big implications for the elections in that state. And in the fight for control of the Senate, things are looking tough for the Democrats, but some red states might be turning blue. NPR's politics editor Charlie Mattesian joins us now from Washington. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Robin.
And start with the Supreme Court emergency application sent out 5 a.m. Saturday morning. As we said, it will allow the state of Texas to enforce its tough voter ID standards in the November 4th election. Some analysts saying the court's just signaling it's loath to tinker with states this late in the game. But what does that law do and what could it mean in Texas?
Well, critics of this new voter ID law, such as civil rights groups and some Democratic-oriented groups, say that the new law's requirements could prevent more than 600,000 registered Texas voters from voting in person because they lack the appropriate identification. And a large percentage of those voters, actually it's more like a disproportionate percentage, they would be African American or Hispanic. Now, if you talk to defenders of the law, which is namely Republicans in Texas, they insist that the standards have been in place for a few statewide elections already, and there's no evidence that it's caused voter suppression. What I think is important to note here is that this is the first time the law would be applied to a federal general election. So in other words, this on Tuesday, November 4th, that's going to be the first big November election where this voting regime would be in place. So we'll finally get a very clear idea of the impact.
Yeah, and we'll keep an eye on that. And staying with election laws, Charlie, a lot of people watching the Senate races in Louisiana and Georgia, where candidates have to get at least 50% of the vote to win. If not, there will be runoffs. We've talked about this, but those races are looking very tight right now. So what's your look ahead of how nasty things might be if there are runoffs?
Well, it's really hard to believe, Robin, but it's true that because of the likelihood that one or maybe even two Senate races are going to be forced into runoff elections, we actually might not know which party controls the Senate until January. Mm-hmm. That's January 2015. And here's how it would happen. If the Senate ends up being tied on election night, control could come down to, say, a Senate runoff in Louisiana. And that runoff doesn't take place until December 6th. Or it could come down to Georgia's Senate seat. And if that race went into a runoff, then we wouldn't have an answer until January 6th, which is when the Georgia runoff is scheduled. Mm-hmm. And you could just imagine what kind of political circus that would turn out to be. Because if there was an additional month or two of uncertainty about who controls the Senate, you can just see those runoff campaigns would end up being nasty, brutish, and really ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, there's that. And so you know, there are people guessing that it might be up to a runoff in either state. Control of the Senate might be up to that. But you know, we've been hearing Democrats are losing ground. They're in danger of losing the majority in the Senate. So what do you think? I mean, what is the likelihood? We've talked about there might be a runoff, but what is the likelihood it will be that close?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Republicans still occupy the commanding heights when it comes to Senate races. And the simple fact is that Democrats are defending many more Senate seats than Republicans are this year. And many of those seats that Democrats are defending are in red states. And that's why you see all these political forecasts that say Republicans are favored to take over the Senate. But it's not a done deal that Democrats are going to lose the Senate. And one reason is that some of the Republican-controlled seats that everyone expected were going to be safe this year, they've turned out to be not so safe. Democrats never expected that they might have a shot at winning Senate seats in Kansas and South Dakota. Yet, because of a variety of local factors, they're actually still in the hunt in those two states. And then that would be a really painful irony for the Republican Party if they ended up not winning the Senate because they couldn't capture or hold seats in two of the reddest states on the political map.
Yeah. keep an eye on that. So over the weekend, President Obama campaigned in Illinois. He hadn't been campaigning because of the Ebola outbreak. He also campaigned in Maryland. This is for Democratic candidates for governors in those states. We know the president's approval rating down around 40%. That's the lowest of his presidency. Senate candidates, some, don't want his help on the campaign trail. And then there's been this talk about a possible worse case for the president and the Democratic Party because of this potential October surprise of the handling of the Ebola outbreak. So what's your sense of whether or not this president right now can be effective in helping Democrats even in a governor's race?
Well, in many states, the president is so unpopular that no candidate would see him as an asset, whether it's a Senate candidate or a gubernatorial candidate. But there are still some Democratic-oriented states where he can help, and that's where you're seeing him show up these days. The president is especially effective at rallying the base, and he also remains very popular with African Americans. So he's very helpful to campaigns like the ones you've seen him travel to, like for Governor Quinn and Lieutenant Governor Brown in Maryland. If you look at the Maryland event, for example, yesterday, the president went to Prince George's County, which is a majority black suburban county where the president won 90% of the vote in 2012. Now, in a very populous suburb like that where he remains fairly popular, he's a very big asset to a campaign because in that case, Lieutenant Governor Brown, the Democrat, he needs a very big Democratic turnout from that county, and the president's visit could generate some much-needed enthusiasm. And when you look at a state like Maryland, it's so comfortably Democratic that there really isn't much worry that an Obama appearance could backfire to a significant degree. No. It's mostly just upside.
And by the way, just staying with governors for a second, why are we hearing that so many incumbent governors from both parties may lose their seats?
Well, that's a great question, because I think if there's this overarching narrative in governor's races this year, it's that there appears to be an unusually high number of incumbents in trouble. If you were to look at the map, there are probably at least 10 incumbents who are currently in races, and these are incumbents in both parties, that are currently in races that might be said to be toss-ups and within the margin of error in the polls. And I think one reason is that, unlike, say, in House and Senate races, governor's races tend not to be highly nationalized affairs. They're somewhat insulated from the national political climate, so many of these elections are playing out according to the rhythms and political peculiarities of each individual state and governor.
Yeah, and those can get pretty peculiar. NPR politics editor Charlie Mattesian, as we look ahead at the midterms, how did this happen? Here they are, November 4th. They're right around the corner. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
A report out this month from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says heroin overdose deaths doubled in the U.S. in a recent three-year period. In some states, the numbers are even worse. In North Carolina, for example, 38 people died from heroin overdoses in 2010. That figure soared to 183 last year. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, North Carolina Public Radio's Jeff Tiberi reports.
Heroin is a dangerously addictive opioid. It gives users a euphoric high for less than the cost of a decent lunch. But too often, those users become addicts who can't stop.
I woke up with a needle in my arm, and I don't know how long I was gone. I just remember my baby knocking on the door crying.
Brandy Martinez wiped away tears of her own while describing a battle with addiction. Heroin has dozens of nicknames and many chemical variations. A new one came to North Carolina in April. Jim Albright is the emergency services director in Guilford County.
Oftentimes it's been mixed with an agent called acetylfentanyl, which makes it at least five times more powerful than standard heroin.
Acetylfentanyl is a designer drug that has no medicinal purpose. Its potency is alarming. In High Point, a city of about 100,000 people, police recorded 17 overdoses last year, with one death. In the last 6 months of this year, the numbers are way up, 102 overdoses and 11 deaths. Dr. Anthony Steele is with Alcohol and Drug Services, a nonprofit that provides treatment to addicts.
We're seeing people dying or overdosing in bathrooms of restaurants. We're seeing people overdosing on park benches. We're seeing people overdosing in their homes.
In North Carolina, across a four-year period, heroin overdose deaths increased 450%. Earlier this month, the CDC reported heroin deaths in the U.S. doubled between 2010 and 2012. That report shows at the same time deaths from overdoses of opioid painkillers are decreasing, although many more people still die each year from that problem than die from heroin. Dr. Jim Finch is an addiction medicine specialist. He's been working in the area of opiate addiction for 20 years.
It can be as simple as what's the access to a particular grade of heroin in a particular community, who's dealing it, how's it coming into that community, or it can be as global as the geopolitics around the United States' choices in Afghanistan to not adequately suppress opium production.
Firm data is not yet available for 2014, but hospital officials in several North Carolina cities expect that heroin overdoses and deaths will rise by about double compared to last year. They do have a weapon to help keep those numbers down.
This is our main med bag right here. In here we have a lot of different items. Here's the Narcan.
Richard Matthews is an EMS field training officer. He's opening compartments and unzipping gear in the back of an ambulance. Narcan, generic name naloxone, is an opioid antagonist. It reverses the effects of heroin and prescription painkillers. Think of it as similar to an EpiPen. In response to the growing number of heroin deaths and overdoses in the state, Narcan is being used twice as frequently and with more success. Again, Dr. Anthony Steele.
Make this medication readily available to individuals who may be in situations that may be, you know, in their home, or they may be in, you know, shooting galleries or whatever, that they have this medication available to bring someone out of an overdose state.
North Carolina lawmakers passed a bill last year making access to Narcan easier. Since then, more than 4,400 kits have been handed out to friends and family members. Caretakers say the drug needs to be combined with education and a move toward treatment.
People are ashamed to come in and get help because they have a substance abuse problem.
Ron Rao is the executive director of Alcohol and Drug Services for Guilford County. He's been battling the stigma attached to addiction for years.
This compulsive need to satisfy the opioid receptors in the brain has to be healed. It's no longer a matter about just saying no, because your brain has changed.
Jennifer Harris still gets those urges to use.
Heroin high and a pill high is, not going to lie, it's amazing. You know, you have all the energy in the world. You feel like you're Superwoman.
At one point, Harris was spending $400 a day on heroin. The 31-year-old mother of two says she has been clean for 2 years. Like many, her long-term care includes taking methadone, an FDA-approved synthetic opioid designed to help ease withdrawal symptoms. Symptoms, she says, are unbearable.
Your heart is racing, you're sweating, and you are throwing up all at the same time. You need a toilet and a trash can. You can't move. I can't even explain it to you. I would really, really rather have my brains blowed out than to deal with that.
There was a methadone clinic in High Point, but due to considerable budget cuts, it closed 2 years ago. It's now the largest city in North Carolina without such a facility. There are critics of methadone. It's a high-risk treatment in which the programs are regulated very tightly. Too much methadone is fatal. Again, Dr. Jim Finch, the addiction medicine specialist.
Methadone programs vary widely, and some methadone programs are very conscientious, others are not so much. Some methadone programs have physicians who are prescribing the methadone that really know what they do, what they're doing, and are knowledgeable. Some are not particularly experienced at all.
Finch says some doctors are overprescribing methadone and other pain pills. He says that remains a fundamental problem with addiction. He recalled a conversation with one patient.
I said, well, do you have enough methadone to last you until you can get into treatment? He said, no, and I hate to go back to my friend's grandmother to buy more. And I said, your friend's grandmother, what's that about? And his wife chimed in and said, yes, there's a group of grandmothers in our town. They have a Bible study group. And everybody knows where the Bible study group meets that week, because after Bible study, they all stick around and you can drop by and sit around in the kitchen and buy their extra medicine.
Long-term care is effective for some, including Brandy Martinez. She says it has been 2.5 years since she woke up with that needle in her arm. Today, she says she's working and focused on her 5 kids.
They can be proud of me again. And I'm proud of myself, but it makes me feel like the best mom in the world. Even though I'm not, we all make mistakes. Like, they trust me now.
Moving forward, clinicians say even more control of narcotics is needed, and increased public awareness will encourage others who need it to seek help. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi.
We want to update you now on what's going on with Ebola in the U.S. The quarantine is over for several dozen people in Dallas who were being monitored for Ebola, including the girlfriend and family of Thomas Eric Duncan, the Liberian man who died of the virus earlier this month. Dallas officials announced today that nearly all of the 48 people on the original watch list have passed the 21-day incubation period and that there is zero chance that they could have Ebola. The handful left on that original list are expected to be in the clear soon. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins today urged people in Dallas to be compassionate and welcoming to everyone coming out of quarantine, including five children who will be going back to school tomorrow.
This, I believe, is a defining moment for Dallas. The world is watching Dallas, and Dallas must determine if Dallas will deal with this with grace and compassion and have the thing that separates us from all other animals is the ability to reason and our faith. We need to be able to have reason, and we need to have faith in the facts and the science.
Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings said having dozens of people come through the incubation period without contracting the virus is bearing out that science of what is known about Ebola transmission and prevention, and he says he's feeling encouraged by the news.
There's no question today is a milestone day. It's a hurdle that we need to get over, but there are other hurdles to also jump.
Health officials are still monitoring 120 more people, many of them healthcare workers who may have had some kind of contact with one of the three U.S. Ebola patients. That incubation period ends November 7th. And of course, we will continue to follow this story and stay tuned later today for All Things Considered and the latest on the Ebola outbreak.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And if you went into any big box store this past weekend, you no doubt saw that annual holiday mashup, Halloween costumes next to the decorative turkey napkins and the pre-lit Christmas trees. It is time for the Halloween, Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year's retail season. And this year, store managers are optimistic. Marilyn Gwax is a senior business editor for NPR. And Marilyn, start with Halloween. I am resisting. I still think it's too early. But do you have an idea of how it's going?
Yes, you know, that's one of those spending holidays that the retailers love, but people actually spend more on Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, but that's a lot of services, you know, delivering flowers and restaurant meals. Halloween, it gets you into the store. You get up off the couch, you go in there, and you're looking for costumes and candy and especially decorations these days.
Right. And you might buy something else along the way. But decorations, speaking of my home, they're huge. I mean, it's a small industry.
It's become a big thing because of the electronics now. Instead of just cutting up that pumpkin and making a jack-o'-lantern, people want bubbling cauldrons and the animated jumping spiders and witches that will start talking to you. So that really drives a lot of people to get into the mall or into a big box store to shop for that. So forecasters right now are pretty optimistic about sales this year. They slacked off during the recession, but we seem to be back on track. And the National Retail Federation is calling for sales of $7.4 billion for Halloween, and that's up from last year from about $7 billion.
Well, we have about 20 talking witches for the three children that come. but how does this Halloween bode for the later holiday season?
Well, it is sort of a predictor for the retail season of the holidays because the same factors that drive the economy now will be driving it in November and December, most likely. That is, we've got better job numbers. You know, we're below 6% unemployment. And also gasoline is a lot cheaper. So is natural gas. Food prices have simmered down. So consumers are really in better shape.
So give us some forecasts.
Well, the National Retail Federation has an official prediction for a boost in sales of 4.1%. And that, you know, that's pretty healthy given that overall inflation is a lot lower than that. So in other words, it isn't just keeping up with price increases. It means people really are going to get out there and spend more. More sales mean that there will be more people hired. So there could be up to 800,000 seasonal workers. And that would exceed last year's number. There were about 768,000 last year.
Yeah.
So more people have an opportunity to pick up money in the evenings working part-time. And that means families will be in even better shape to spend even more money. So it's pretty positive.
All good, but obviously things could go wrong.
Yeah, there are always things that go wrong. You know, one thing we were worrying about this year watching is the stock market. It's turned really volatile. If it should fall a lot, that might scare some of the more affluent shoppers. wage increases have not been great, and we have these wild cards out there. There could be an Ebola panic, you know, that throws off holiday travel, or people don't want to be in crowded malls. And weather is always a possibility. You remember last winter, it was a particularly tough winter with a lot of snowstorms and persistent cold weather. If we have another December like that, it could discourage sales. But assuming that everything goes pretty well, there will be some hot gifts out there. And this, it looks like the big thing this year will be the iPhone 6 and those digital fitness things. I've got one strapped on. How many steps did I take today? Those things are really popular this year, so we should see some pretty good sales in those areas.
Okay, but it is October. So we'll have you back to talk more about that. Marilyn G. Wax, Senior Business Editor for NPR. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I know some of you are boycotting this whole holiday retail push, not buying that talking witch. But for others of us, resistance is futile. You're listening to Here and Now.
And if I were to ask you, what is the most popular TV network amongst affluent women? What would you say? Okay, here's a hint.
First-time buyers Ben and Mashonda are looking for a house as unique as they are.
I'm Carter Osterhaus, and this is a million-dollar room.
Sam and Monica are looking for that perfect property.
We're looking for our dream home.
But their ideal dream house is out of reach.
$1.6 million.
It's right where we want to be in the city, but we can't have it.
That's where the Property Brothers come in.
Those are just a sample of some of the shows on HGTV. That's the answer. It's been on the air for 20 years now and is still one of the most popular channels on cable. But why? Meredith Blake has been reporting on this for the Los Angeles Times. She's with us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, and how well are they doing by the numbers?
HGTV is doing very well. They're a top 10 cable network in prime time. They also do particularly well on the weekends when a lot of people kind of tune in to relax after a long week of work. And they're also a number one network on cable with women, with affluent women, defined as women who make over $100,000 a year.
The number one network among that group.
Yes, that's right.
And for people who don't ever watch HGTV, give us a sense of what they do. What would we find if we tuned in right now?
You'll find variations on a theme, which is basically people buying, selling, renovating property, homes. And it's always kind of, you know, one of the beautiful things about the network is that it's always kind of, it's pretty reliable. Any time of day you're going to tune in, you're going to find some variation on that theme.
That it's not that you're tuning in for a specific show necessarily. You're just tuning in to get this HGTV brand and all the shows kind of flow into that theme.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are people certainly do have their favorites. I mean, you one thing... you know, people are partisans for different shows on the network. But, you know, if you're someone who likes to sort of take a voyeuristic glimpse into other people's homes and how they live their lives, HGTV will always deliver in that department.
And they are famous for their show House Hunters, which has been on the air now for about 15 years, right?
Yeah, since 1999, I believe, is when it first aired.
And that is what?
That is a show that is almost so simple you can't believe someone didn't come up with it earlier, which is basically it's just people looking for houses. And in each episode, you know, sometimes it's a couple, sometimes it's a single person, sometimes it's a whole family. They're looking for a house and they have a list of demands. Usually they're kind of very specific, sometimes maddeningly so. And they tour three houses and decide which one they're going to end up living in or sometimes renting.
This has been called property porn, by the way.
Yes. Yes. I think there is a way that it satisfies, like I said before, this voyeuristic urge that people have to catch a glimpse of other people's lives. And especially on House Hunters, you know, since so many of the people featured in the show are couples, you also get kind of a glimpse into their relationship. So there is this kind of intimate quality to it that I think is very appealing to a lot of viewers.
But there are a lot of copycats now. How has HGTV managed to hold on to its audience with something that can be very easily copied on other channels?
One thing that they've done is they've sort of avoided these kind of huge breakout hits. I mean, earlier this kind of in the early aughts, you had a lot of big shows like Trading Spaces was a huge breakout hit for TLC. That's also something that was kind of also in the home space. That show, people decorated their neighbors' houses, basically. And that was a huge hit. That got like 12 million viewers or something. Sometimes it beat stuff in broadcast primetime. But it also saw, you know, people got sick of it really quickly. HGTV has a way of really not beating a dead horse. They all of their shows get between in primetime get, you know, around 1 to 2 million viewers, which is pretty modest compared to some other shows. But the fact is they don't wear out the viewer with one breakout hit, and they keep the formula kind of the same. And it's pleasant, it's reliable, it's voyeuristic without being sort of sensationalistic.
And it's popular among women, as you said, who are making more than $100,000. It's the number one network. But it's also popular among their family members who watch with them.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a very fun show to watch. I mean, I know that I enjoy watching it with my husband. It's a you know, especially the House Hunters and House Hunters International kind of franchise. Because like I said before, you kind of get an insight into how other people live their lives. It gives you a chance to sort of maybe judge them a little bit, to wonder why they can't live in a smaller house or settle without the granite countertops or whatever it is. And, you know, it's also a little bit of a, you know, playing into the American dream of real estate thing. I mean, people are endlessly obsessed with that, and it gives us a way to kind of relive that fantasy every night at 10.
And I see that they are the number one revenue generator for their parent company, Scripps. What do you think it tells us about ourselves that Americans in general love this kind of programming about fixing up houses and, you know, working on property and gardening and all that?
I think it's that people just love, you know, HGTV. It's not always a happy ending on these shows, but there is kind of a neat formula to all of them. You know, anyone who's seen two episodes of House Hunters can tell you that by the third act, the couple's going to sit down and hash out which houses they've looked at and the plus and minuses of each. There's a really satisfying formula to them. And especially when that's tied to something, you know, that's so kind of innate in the American identity, like consumerism, like property ownership, people are going to be drawn to that.
Why did they survive after the housing crash? A lot of people were thinking that this channel would not last after the crash of the housing market.
While the network has mostly, you know, in its 20 years been about real estate, it wasn't really guilty as of much of the excess as some of the other networks were. You know, there were all these flipping shows kind of in the middle aughts, 2005, 2006. There was just a glut of these shows about flipping real estate. HGTV had a few of them, but, you know, their shows tend to be a little milder. They're not as over the top, not as brash, I guess you could say. And I think that was one thing that kept them above water. You know, some other networks like A&E and Bravo cut back on their real estate programming after the crash. HGTV kept going, and they made some minor adjustments in their schedule. They added some shows that were kind of more sensitive to where people were. They had a show called Income Property, you know, about how to find a house or, you know, a piece of property that you could also make money off of. So they tweaked their lineup a little bit, but I think because they were always a little more restrained in some ways, they managed to stay afloat and to thrive, really.
Meredith Blake, reporter with the LA Times, talking with us about HGTV, which, by the way, is about to expand to Asia this winter.
Yeah, that's right, which is interesting. You know, you can see kind of this expansion of consumerism and interest in acquiring property overseas. We're exporting it like crazy.
Meredith, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
A report out today from a new think tank called City Observatory finds that cities are attracting young adults, even cities that have seen population decline, places like Buffalo and Cleveland. And those are two of the places that our digital and social media producer Rachel Rohr visited during her month on the road talking to young adults across the country. She's now back in our studios. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And what did you find about this idea about whether people stay in one place, young people, or travel to another?
Well, you know, I crunched the numbers, and a little more than half of the young people I spoke with say they plan to stay where they are, while the rest plan to leave. In small towns, some people couldn't imagine leaving their family and friends. Some are returning to their hometowns after college in order to start a business or take over the family business. But as you might imagine, some young people can't wait to leave their hometown. Here's 20-year-old Blake Peden in Rena Lara, Mississippi.
I would go anywhere besides Mississippi. I just want to get out of here, really. Mississippi is just kind of not a lot of opportunities and stuff like other places. Hmm.
In urban areas, many young people seemed likely to stick around as long as they're happy with the job opportunities. I also met young people who see the world at their fingertips and don't know where they might end up. But some people I interviewed had already found a new place to call home. Here's 29-year-old Erin Wright, who moved from San Jose, California, to a small town in Kentucky, where she works at Kelly Beekeeping.
I grew up in larger cities, and, you know, I like to visit them, but if someone paid me to live there again, I wouldn't do it. I just like the community here, and I really like the community just within Kelly's a lot.
So one young person wanting to get out of a small town, one wanting to stay in one. But overall, what's your big takeaway?
Well, in addition to the question of whether to stay or go, I asked young people whether they plan to vote in the midterm elections next month and what issues are most important to them. In terms of voting, 45% of the young people I interviewed told me they do plan to vote. So 32% said no, they will not vote, and 23% weren't sure yet.
And why?
Among the young people who do plan to vote, some were motivated by a particular issue or candidate, but many felt that voting is important and something everyone should do. Here's 28-year-old Stephanie Erhaugh in Milford, Pennsylvania, on why she votes.
If I don't, then a majority of my friends won't, you know what I mean? It just takes one person to just start a line of getting it going.
For those who won't vote, some said they just don't follow politics or have an opinion on who should be elected. Some said they missed the registration date. But some were very deliberate about not voting, saying there are no good options or that they just don't trust government. Here's 23-year-old Jamie Hovis in Hernando, Mississippi.
The people that are in it, you don't really know anything about them because one person's saying one thing, the other person's saying another thing, and you don't know the whole truth about anything.
Huh. So those are some of the overriding thoughts. What about the issues?
There was a wide range in answers as far as what issues are most important to the young people I spoke with. An 18-year-old told me that the issue she follows most closely is the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. A 28-year-old told me that drugs are her top concern. She's had friends die of overdoses, and she wants kids to know the risks. But there were repeating themes. Jobs, one, is the most common answer, followed by the environment. And tied for third most common answer were LGBT issues, including gay marriage, and religious values, people who said they vote in step with their church.
So these are young people speaking. So you traveled 7,500 miles through 25 states. That's half the states in the country. Do you have a favorite place?
One of the places I found most interesting was Provo, Utah. It's overwhelmingly members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which owns Brigham Young University.
Well, interesting, because you got a lot of response to the whole trip, but you got response when you were at BYU. You talked to a young man who was lobbying to allow beards on campus. Brad Crabtree wrote that, you know, you can get a beard card to get a pass and get a beard.
That's true. You can get a medical exception. So if you have acne or something and you can't shave, you can get an exemption from the university. And actually, Shane and I talked about that. You can hear the full interview with Shane on herenow.org. But staying with Provo, part of what I found so interesting about Provo was, you know, I interviewed dozens of young people across the country, and only two people swore on tape while I was interviewing them. And both of those people were in Provo. Now, neither of them was a member of the LDS Church, but I started noticing this all over Provo. You know, people who had tattoos, piercings, were swearing at volume, coffee in one hand, cigarette in the other hand. And I realized that there is this counterculture movement, and it's very prominent. Many of the young people who are not Mormon really want to wear it on their sleeve.
Well, there you go. Interesting observation about Provo. But meanwhile, you have been traveling the country in your Vanagon, which some of us had not heard of, but it's a van camper. And it turns out a lot of your followers have suggested names for it.
Oh, that's great, because we need one.
Well, now you have many to choose from. Michael Poor suggests Vincent Van Gogh. Get it? Van Gogh.
That's a good one.
Larry Frederick suggests Fred. Ann Jerome said my friend's Vanagon was called Piglet. And Paul Lacey suggests Art Vandelay, which is a Seinfeld reference. It's the George's character when he was a salesman. So there you go. Does any suit your Vanagon?
There's lots to choose from there. We're going to have to think about it. Serious decision.
And she will still take suggestions at facebook.com/hereandnowradio, and we'll hook you up to all her stories as well. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And believe it or not, there is one place where Art Vandelay, Rachel's van, could not go, and that is Mars. And that's where we're going next, because last night a comet made a dramatic flyby past the red planet, making it the first time a comet has come so close to a planet in recorded history. It's also the first time this comet, which is called Siding Spring, visited the inner solar system. Kelly Beatty is senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. He's here with us to discuss. Kelly, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
And sighting spring sounds to me like a run at a ski resort, but where did this comet come from and what is it made of?
Could be. Comets are named after the discoverer or where they were discovered. So this is an observatory in Australia. It was discovered January of 2013 of last year, on its way in from an unimaginably distant part of the solar system, really tens of billions of miles away. And because of that, this comet is seeing the sun's warmth for the first time. It's turned on. Gases are escaping. It's fizzing. It's bubbling. It's seething. And it just happens to have been passing about 85,000 miles from the surface of Mars yesterday. A very, very dramatic thing.
And we know that there are five orbiters near Mars right now, some of them from NASA, some from other space agencies. Did it come close to those? Or are we going to learn information from those orbiters about this comet?
Yes and yes. The comet has this big cloud around it, which actually slammed into Mars, and they were worried about little particles and such. So the NASA orbiters were positioned to be behind Mars, so Mars acted as a shield. Everything's fine. They're all working great. And right now they're in the midst of taking as many images and recording spectra and other data as they can. For example, one of the spacecraft, a NASA one and an Indian one that just arrived, study the atmosphere. They're looking to see if the comet has contaminated the atmosphere of Mars. Mm. How cool is that?
Yeah. And what if a comet were to come so close to Earth? Because we've said that this would be much closer than the moon is to Earth, this comet was to Mars. What would it do to Earth if that happened, if it came so close?
Right. It would be about a third of the distance from the Earth to the moon. So it would be really close. Literally, our atmosphere is so thick, it would not have affected us at all. But boy, would it have been bright. It would be the brightest thing in the sky, maybe not as bright as the moon, but certainly brighter than any other star or planet. I wish we had a comet like that.
Is there going to be a sighting on Earth of this comet at any point, or when's the next comet that's coming close to us?
So this comet, from our perspective, is very faint. You need a really substantial telescope to see it. And some people are taking pictures to support NASA. Hubble is in the game. We don't know when the next comet will come by. They come from so far away, they're icy until the sun warms them up. And only then, when they turn on, do we actually see them.
We do know there's a partial solar eclipse coming this Thursday, but we won't be able to see it here.
Every place in the U.S. and Canada except the Northeast. Go figure.
Well, let's all fly to the West Coast. Kelly Beatty from Sky and Telescope magazine, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I think, Kelly, you once called them big flying hairballs in the sky comet. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.